Dark Wings.
Dork Words.
The Game of Thrones Podcast.
Episode 13.
Conan versus Conan.
Welcome to episode 13. I am your host, Chuck Davis, and with me this week are...
Greg Jaxies,
Brendan J.D. Riley,
Molly Welsh,
and Eric Salonis.
All right, so we drug our feet a little bit recording this one. It's been a month since we saw the new Conan movie, roughly.
I blocked it out.
It's a little over
exactly.
A month.
Yeah.
We lost about 2 hours.
We went on opening weekend, so that was like 1920.
It was mid-August. Yeah. It's been like August. A month and a half.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I personally was so dispirited after seeing the movie. Being such a... I guess you could call me a diehard Conan fan, since I've seen the first movie maybe a dozen times, and I've read this stack of Conan books when I was in high school, and I'm currently reading a stack of Conan comic books on and off when I'm not reading Dance with Dragons. And I really, really, really wanted the new Conan movie to be good.
We
so,
all did.
You know, expectations are always color the experience. And, this podcast, I think I'm going to let you guys kind of pile on the new movie a little bit. And then I'll just wistfully try to remember the Conan that once was and might have been.
Let's talk about why you had such high hopes, though. Because Conan has been a part of our culture since it was written in the 30s. And there have been numerous... You know, like you said, there are books, there are graphic novels, there are movies, there are... How many books are there? Because there's a stack as big as the microphone over there.
Yeah, there's a stack of 9 of them here. These are the books that were kind of published by Ace Fantasy in the maybe late 70s or 80s that were edited and compiled by L. Sprague de Camp. And each one kind of has an introduction and a foreword by him where he describes... the process he went through of going through the original manuscripts.
Robert
trying,
E. Howard?
Robert E. Howard's original stories. L. Sprague de Camp kind of republished them for, you know, in the wave, I guess, of the late 70s where fantasy became really popular again. And him, or Robert E. Howard being sort of a father of modern fantasy, at least in the eyes of the people who were familiar with the genre or whatever, he says he kind of took it upon himself to republish all these stories. He tried to put them in some sort of chronological order, and so he has notes in each book where he kind of talks about the choices that he made and trying to guess or decide which story came before another. And he even renames places and characters and things.
Really?
He takes a lot of liberties with it. So I think there are other, like, more Conan purists out there that probably hate this series of books because... L. Sprague de Camp went in there and changed stuff, and it's not the pure original content. But I picked up one of these up, I was just flipping through it, and it says something like, only 18 Conan stories were originally published during Robert E. Howard's lifetime. But since then, they've all been, like I said, posthumously poured over and you know, analyzed and thought about and expanded into, you know, multiple series of comic books over the years. When I was in high school, there was a Conan the King series that was really cool that I collected that I think was put out by Marvel Comics. And there had been a Conan the Barbarian series prior to that. And Dark Horse just has, in the past 10 years, done another Conan series.
There's on Netflix, it's coming out soon, but there's an animated feature about Red Nails, the story Red Nails. And we tried to watch it and realized that it hadn't come out yet, but it's like, of course it's Ron Perlman doing the voices because he's in the voices for everything like that, but it's still being done even after the latest flop. But the draw for the podcast was because it had been around, Conan has been around for so long and there's all these things we could do with it, and then Jason Momoa being a badass.
Right.
We had high hopes.
Like the theme of our podcast in general is just taking... what is arguably maybe the greatest work of fantasy ever written and analyzing its adaptation to the screen. And so, you know, in kind of flailing around for other stuff to talk about between seasons, it seems like, you know, whenever there's other adaptations of literature to the screen, well, fantasy adaptations, I guess, in particular. It seemed like a natural choice. And then, of course, the Jason Momoa link just sealed the deal.
Well, and Schwarzenegger, I mean, we all, to prepare for this podcast, we all watched Conan the Barbarian, old school, and some of us watched Destroyer, and then we went to see the new one altogether. But Conan the Barbarian was such a great, you know, early 80s, paving the way for these other epic fantasy movies, and it's Schwarzenegger. God, it's really awful. But it, I mean, it's great, but it's awful.
Yeah.
We realized that in the first, what was it, like 15 to 20 minutes of the movie, the only thing he says is, ow, 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 ow. He's just screaming. And the first thing he says is the whatever quote about the lamentations of your women. And it was amazing.
Well,
like,
the best part.
What is best in life? That quote.
Yeah, that was a great reveal, because I didn't remember that he doesn't speak, you know, in the first. And then when he does, it's like, oh, stop. But
well, he lives, he loves, and then he slays. And then he actually says a good line.
Right. Well, and then with Momoa, never mind. We'll get to the new movie. But
it
the old movies...
Momoa says, hey.
Hey. And then Shannon turns to me and she goes, did he just yell hey at that guy? I'm like, yeah, he did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. No. Hey.
Hold up.
Hey.
What's going on?
Oh, my God.
Slow
okay.
your roll. Slow your roll.
Eric, I know that
let me talk at you.
One of the draws for the old Conan movies, because the first one was rated R,
mm-hmm.
and the second one, Destroyer, was rated PG,
mm-hmm.
And we get Grace Jones in the PG, and I know that Eric has sort of a crush on the Grace Jones of the 80s. Maybe just always?
I just explain
why you like what your connection is to that movie.
Yeah.
No, my connection to that movie is, it was actually the first fantasy movie I ever saw as a child, because they played it on TV all the time because it was PG, and so that was my introduction to fantasy, which was probably a poor introduction to it, but, you know, that was, you know, I had nothing to compare against at that time. But in retrospect, looking, when I watched it again as an adult, you know, seeing how terrible a movie it was, but I still had, like, these, just this fun memory of, like, Grace Jones, who's just, like, insane.
It's
in the...
such a freak. And that's Grace Jones.
You know, her saying lines like, you know, when the princess asks her, how do you attract a man? She's all like, grab him, you know? like, and then, of course, my other, like, thing in the movie is I for some reason, had this, like, obsession with Sarah Douglas, who is also in the movie as Evil Queen Taramis.
Right.
With all the capes. The capes, capes,
oh
capes.
God. And the hair.
And the hair.
Yeah.
And the capes. And the capes and hair.
Growing up with those things, mm-hmm. and like, I don't know, they paved the way for some of the, for the Krulls and for the,
yes.
the other late 80s movies. And, you know, forgive me, all you podcasters who are looking up which movie came out first, whatever. I know that Red Sonja came out first, otherwise they would have probably had Conan in as Conan, but alas.
I think the original Conan movie was a modest hit,
mm-hmm.
and that it was based on that success of that, it probably greenlit movies like Krull.
Mm-hmm.
Like, all right, give me another fantasy, you know?
Yeah.
You know, another 20 or 10 or $5 million budget.
Well, that always
happens. I don't know how much they spent on this.
In movies, you know, Transformers came out, then Transmorphers. You know, they always try to,
really?
To go on the...
Oh,
you haven't
so
heard of
sorry.
Those?
That's not,
that.
That's not how those movies work.
In mentioning all the crazy characters in Destroyer, I forgot about Wilt Chamberlain.
Yeah.
Wilt.
Oh, Wilt.
Anyway.
Well, in the first one, in the first movie, when the spirits are, like, flying around and they're trying to save him, like,
yeah.
that was some of the...
That was pretty cool.
First, like, creepy graphics.
There's a lot about the first one that's successful. You
yeah.
know? It's got great art direction, and
yeah.
it's just got, just, like, a serious tone that never, well, arguably never becomes jokey. Like, the second movie is just
is
ridiculous
yeah.
from start to finish.
Yeah.
yeah.
But the first one, it's got, it's at least rooted in the source material.
Yeah.
Just enough to do it justice without really bringing to life, you know, what it could have or should have been.
Right.
I remember in high school when it came out, I was, you know, like a big Dungeons & Dragons geek. And I was collecting or subscribing to Dragon Magazine, which would come out with like D&D stuff every month. And there was a big editorial article in there by, you know, one of the big D&D guys. Maybe it was even Gary Gygax, the creator of Dungeons & Dragons,
oh, really?
Wrote a big editorial about how he was all up in arms about the Conan movie because of all the things they got wrong. You know, just down to his hair color is wrong. And,
oh my God.
And you know, stuff like that.
We've never complained about that on our podcast. Anyway. Well, it's good that we have all these positive, like, that Conan has a positive backbone, and that there are good things to be found, and that, speaking of source material, all of us prepared for this in some way, whether it was, like, finding all of the books, and...
and putting them in my truck.
I mean,
and dragging them out for the podcast.
And somebody let me borrow, like, a complete Conan collection, and I started to read it, and it was just so dense. Like, I started to read the beginning where he explains about the world that the Conan stories are happening in. Oh my god, it was like way too many pages long, and I didn't care. And he would set it up and say, there's this whole civilization, and this is how they worked, and this is what they believed in, and then there was a meteor or something, and then they weren't anymore.
It's like reading
and now
the
there's this new one, and it's like,
Hobbit.
What? Why do I have to care about any of that?
Were you accidentally reading a Dungeon Master's Guide?
But I read enough to, like, get a sense, and then I would flip around, which was kind of fun, and just, like, open random pages of random stories and see what creepy thing was happening, what celestial orb is floating in front of this woman's face, and whatever. But when we went to see the new movie, and it started, and we all were confused because we thought it was a documentary. Thank you, Morgan Freeman. He was narrating, and I recognized the text. I recognized it straight out of that chapter. So,
really?
Yeah. I mean, I had read the words that he was saying a couple days before, and I felt really smart for about 2 seconds, and then he kept
those
going.
Intro words that are, like, from the first movie? That
yes.
There was a time
there
before
a time,
time when the penguins had a majestic kingdom full of magic and sorcery.
We're going to talk about that for 30 more minutes before we get into the movie.
One definite point, Mako, much better narrator for the story than Morgan Freeman.
Mako.
I
love Mako.
Mako in the first one is still better than Mako
in the second
one.
But Mako in the second one is still pretty cool.
He's of all the side characters, he
comports
himself with the most dignity.
Yeah. Grace Jones with her little tail thing. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
I just like that every time you look at her, she's about to scream. Basically. That's all she does is scream, and she looks so awesome the whole time, just screaming. Anyway.
It's one of her most restrained performances.
I liked Red Sonja a lot more than I liked Conan. Because I was a little girl, and she was totally awesome, and she didn't need nobody. And even though she had Arnold, she's like, I don't need you, let's fight right now. And then they would fight, and then she'd be like, maybe I do need you. I don't need you! And it was awesome. And, like, all the ladies she fought and everything. And, I don't know, it was more relatable for me as a girl. But.
Well, and then the woman who played Valeria in the first Conan movie then played the villainess in Red Sonja.
Okay.
I forget the woman's name.
I don't remember.
Yeah.
There were a
Sandal
lot of crazy
Bergman
women in that movie.
The
Aryan.
Sandal Birkenstock.
But we do want to devote some time at this podcast to how awful the new movie was. And in order for us to do that, we had so much fun at this movie. I have to say that right now. There were 9 of us, and we were watching it. And I don't think I've laughed that much in a really long time. We went to the Exarban Theater here in Omaha. I got to sit next to Shannon, who couldn't be here today, and we were being so inappropriate. It was so fun, and we were giggling with our glasses, and it was awful.
For those listening, don't feel bad, because we weren't disturbing the enjoyment of the other nun people in the theater.
No, they were right there with us. Like, it was great fun. And
all 2 of them.
I know that if I would have gone to see this movie with anybody else, it wouldn't have been such a good experience. So, yes, it was bad, but we had so much fun.
Yeah.
So
also, the theater has a bar.
Yeah, they do. And I asked Brendan to sort of write down, in order what happens so that we could just rip it apart from beginning to end. And we also have a guest-ish. Joshua Daniel has this amazing website, Sketched Screenings. And it's a movie reviewed with a nifty sketch, and he reviewed Conan the Barbarian, and I'm just going to read his first line of the review before we get started with Brendan. It says, take out your swords and, you know what, fuck it, let's just get this piece of shit over with. And then he has a little drawing of Conan, and it says, the sword is his penis. Get it? So,
Brendan. Oh, the sword's his penis!
Makes
yeah.
the whole movie better.
So tell us,
why did
lead
his,
us
why did his
this,
dad
Brendan.
Build him a penis?
didn't it get stolen for 2/3 of the movie?
Well, we already talked about Morgan Freeman having the narrations, but after that happens, we find out that Conan was born of battle, and what this means is that we see a shot of the womb with a sword point going through it and a little fetus. And Ron Perlman does a C-section on the battlefield with his wife.
Was that necessary?
It wasn't successful.
It was just, it was kind
clearly
of...
clearly wasn't trained.
Yeah.
Born of battle is more of, it's a turn of phrase you don't actually have to make it something literal.
You know,
literal.
If you didn't have that, you couldn't have had either Ron Perlman or the mother looking at the sky and screaming, no! Without full effect.
Did they do the tracking shot, the overhead, with the fist in the air?
Pretty sure.
Well, he lifted, I know at the end.
Oh,
he
lifts
the
baby and he's like,
yeah.
It's a combination of Point Break and Rafiki.
Exactly.
You know, actually, his review makes a point that would add to that. If you,
Josh's
if you,
review?
Yeah, if you
go
want me
it.
To add for now. Okay, it says, he says, one scene metaphor. Okay, the first thing we see is some horrible CGI baby Conan in the womb when a sword gets stuck in his mother's belly because apparently they let a preggers woman fight on the battlefield. Mama Conan kills the guy, then she tells Papa Conan that she wants to see her baby before she dies. So and say before she dies. So and say before she dies. So and say.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're experiencing technical difficulties at the moment. Actually, the next 15 minutes of dialogue, which was really funny, where we bash every plot point up to a certain moment, skips. So for your listening pleasure, I've cut it out. As an apology, we would like to present you with a little ditty that will be posted to darkwingsdorkwords.com called The Little Melisandre. Please listen to that. We're going to resume the podcast and skip forward about 15 minutes. And the moment we pick up with is our discussion of the tact involved with Rose McGowan's character trying to seduce her own father in a tent.
So unsafe before
and
she dies. So untouched. Like, no, that's going to be me or anything like that. So.
No, they're just reminding us that these are the evil characters.
Yes.
They
and
don't
mind.
They're
is
evil.
Evil.
No.
Except it's too evil for Zim.
And they're evil
we'll
is to the art of screenwriting.
Yeah.
That's like their biggest crime.
No, he's just not into his own daughter's. He's not into his own daughter's receding hairline.
There was one scene which we'll get to later when everything's crumbling, where they show like a long shot of her trying to walk down a bunch of stairs, and I swear to God, I can see her mouthing, "Goddamn motherfucking boots! I hate these boots."
Well, that also happened
in the
monastery scene too.
She chose
those
boots
after she licked the blood off of all the other monkettes.
Wasn't she like fondling the virgins and like?
Yeah, she was like, "I can taste if you're a virgin."
She cut them with her
and then she
crack dealer
with her Freddy
fingernails.
Yeah,
and I was so excited that she was going to be in this film because Robert Rodriguez was pretty close to completing the development, but he left to do Grindhouse. I mean, I saw posters of that Robert Rodriguez and Rose McGowan were working on a Red Sonja remake that looked pretty awesome. And
so Robert Rodriguez was on board with this movie?
He was. Warner Brothers spent 7 years trying to get the project off the ground, and development attempts were made by the Wachowski brothers. By Robert Rodriguez.
Wachowski brothers.
I know. And a lot of people were like in and out of this. I mean, they wanted to do this, but Schwarzenegger was elected and he couldn't do it. And then, I don't know. There was a lot of things happening.
But they could still do the King Conan movie with Schwarzenegger.
Like in the governorship?
Well, the first two movies.
I'm Conan of California.
The first two movies end with the little teaser of Conan on his throne.
Right.
And Mako just going, oh boy.
Oh boy.
Good.
Well, and it says,
keep the housekeeper away from
me. Wikipedia says that Mickey Rourke was scheduled to play his father, and Ron Perlman took over the character.
Mickey Rourke got a career back?
When Ricky
Ron Paycheck
Ricky
Perlman saves the day.
It says that he was in it twice, and he left the project
a always
second
a good
time in favor of the Immortals film. So Ron Perlman took over
which
in March 2010.
Awesomely bad.
Yeah.
We need to see that one. Because it's Tarsem Singh and it's going to be really pretty.
I love Tarsem Singh, though.
It's going to be Immortals is going to be really pretty, but probably intensely terrible.
Yeah. I hope so. Like, we had so much fun. I hope we have so much fun going to see the Immortals. Yeah. It looks like one of those. But keep going.
So,
just
back
hit
to the plot.
No, I don't think any of this is plot.
So,
no.
Conan catapults the guy
to get their attention
onto to a giant. He's like attached to a giant block of something. Isn't
yeah.
It? And it falls through, smashes the hull of the ship, interrupting the finger sucking of the evil father. And the two of them, they're not even upset that this boat that they just drag across the continent for 20 years is like all fucked up.
Well, they figure out that he's got him, and they're like, oh, he wants a trader for gold. So they meet and they fight. And then there's the sand people.
The sand things were so mummy. Like, it was it was cool until so it mummy. Wasn't. It was cool until they gave us rules, right? There's where it was like, if they're killed where there isn't sand, then they don't come back. But then, it happened a bunch of times where they were killed and
there was
and they
no,
came back and it was
I
stupid.
There was no rhyme or reason to them.
Well, apparently gravity defeats sand.
It's a good, it was actually, like, in my opinion, the best, aside from Kid Conan, like, this was the only, like,
competent
fight.
It was the only scary magic moment in the whole movie.
Right, it was, yeah,
like,
the only bit
they can do creepy stuff.
The only bit of, like, actual magic, even the end is a total fail on that.
But it was just the reveal of the critters, mm-hmm. and like, oh, he's gonna be in trouble, how's he gonna kill the sand guy? And it's, oh, I guess he can just kill him anyway.
Yeah, his sword
but there's
is cool
and there's no distinctive number of them. There's no method of like tracking
how
like which
them?
One is which.
Yeah.
Right.
And they it's just like, oh, we need some CG in this shot, so pop up a sand.
And
a
we
sand
better
zombie.
Have some random scaffolding so that we can climb something.
In good, yeah, yes. An abandoned square somewhere.
Yeah. I mean the meat of the fight was actually like I thought it was actually a good fight. Like, they had good fight choreography, and it was interesting to look at and interesting to track, but it didn't feel like it had any consequence whatsoever.
Right.
Oh, no.
You know, it's just like, oh, sand guy's down, sand guy's up, sand guy's down, sand guy's up.
And Virgin
and just
was,
the
like,
establishing
hiding.
Shot of them waiting there by the scaffolding.
Yeah.
And you could see, oh, they spent more money on this set than the last 10 that we looked at. They're gonna spend some time running around jumping off of holes.
Well, and one of the problems that I had with that fight was that there was the poison that she put on the sword, right? Didn't
sure.
Marique put some poison on the
yeah,
sword?
Yeah, after the sand zombie fight.
Right.
Right.
They
had the
combat.
Single, yeah. And he gets cut, but apparently it's not really, like, horrible poison. It's
you would
just,
think,
like,
oh, wow,
make
they really,
him dizzy
exactly.
poison.
It's just roofie.
Vaseline on the camera lens poison.
Yeah, pretty much. And because he recovers on the boat. And then Zim's men attack him again. They defeat him.
There's a problem here, too. Talk about the boat. The escape into the ocean.
Yes, from sketch screenings, an excerpt on the boat issue. He talks about several things in the movie that make no goddamn sense. He says, for the entire length of the movie, the main bad guy has a team of elephants carrying a huge boat across the wastelands for no reason. There's just literally no reason for this. We keep seeing shots of them carrying it over land, but there's never any bodies of water in sight. There's no dock it came from, and they don't bring it to any bay, so I have to believe he's just had his minions carrying a huge fucking boat for 20 years because he felt like it. And the one time Conan and the main girl get away by jumping off a cliff into the ocean to swim to their black friend's boat, this would be the bad guy's one time to finally say, aha, I've been planning for this for 20 years. Cast the boat into the water after them. Nope, the bad guys just let them get away and continue to carry the boat over land for no goddamn reason.
It would have been great. It would have been great for them to, like, push the boat off that cliff. The one that they jumped into the spider. It's like a 50-foot, it's like a 50-foot cliff that Conan and his lady jump off of. And there's like, oh, shit. Get the boat! The boat. They just heave it off the cliff and it just like flips upside down in midair and shatters on the surface.
Would it have been more awesome, like more awesomely horrible in the movie though, if the boat had been destroyed because of this? Or if in the movie they made it land perfectly and like you just, you know, had to go with it.
Like it flies into the air. Dukes of Hazzard
thing. You jump into it, the elephant.
Will Zim make
and
it? Let's see.
Old Zim has got a bustle and a bundle of trouble now.
Oh, Boss Hogg's gonna throw his hat in the dirt.
So, one of the best parts of the film is when Tamara goes after Conan because he's like, go back to your home and keep her safe. I'm gonna go kill Zim. And then she meets up with him.
Oh, that's the second stupidest thing in the whole movie.
Where
it's
they
like,
go,
Conan,
like,
Conan
far
tells
away,
him
they go
boat.
Like 5 miles.
Conan tells his pirate buddy's like, all right, just keep an eye on this chick. I'm going to go over here and kill this guy. Just whatever you do, protect this girl. He's like, okay.
Hey, go
and
after
then
her.
And then he looks at her looking after her. He's like, oh, you want to get with Conan, huh? Go ahead, go get with him.
Conan played hard to get. Girl saw through ruse. Let's find fuck out.
But then they walk, you know, 5 miles away.
Right, she's
5 miles further inland.
So they're in the middle
in
of the
woods.
Forest,
let's,
right?
Let's not pass up the line.
Yes.
Instead of what is best in life to just crush your enemies,
right, yes.
instead of the famous Conan the Barbarian line, we get what is best, or you don't even get what is best in life.
No, you
just
don't.
Get, Conan, what's your Twitter bio? I live, I love, I slay. That is enough.
I am content.
Right before he says that, he's like, I'm driven by revenge. But,
this other stuff's pretty sweet, too.
I live, love, and slay as hobbies, but revenge is my profession.
Yeah.
And now, no more talking, because we are in a fuckwam. And that is something that Shannon Jaxie's termed.
She said fuck house.
And then they're in a fuck bomb. And then I got a text this week because Eric was excited about recording the podcast. And the text said, what did it
say? Okay, basically we were watching Conan the Barbarian, the original one, and we coined the sexy in that a fuckwom because it looked like a teepee that was like around them. And so,
then
at a certain point, there's this scene where Conan's all like bent on revenge to go after Thulsa Doom, and he's all silent, and Valeria's all like leaning over his shoulder trying to convince him, no, let's just take the king's money and get out of here and live. And Chuck, at one point, as Conan was being all stern and silent, Chuck goes, this is a fuckwom, not a talkwom.
So there's a history of sex shanties.
There is. And so in the new movie, when you know, she goes after him and then they like walk 5 miles and then they go to the
perfect cave with hay.
It wasn't even a cave, it was a house. It was a house with a roof and windows,
there was windows
and a door.
There was light coming through those
three
windows.
Three bears just moved
out.
There
was like perfect
and the only
lighting
thing
in there
was,
too.
That was in there
the
was a big
cameras.
Circular hay bed in the middle just
right.
for Conan.
And it's also at the bottom, seemingly at the bottom of a tidal cave.
Yeah.
Yes.
So if the when the tide comes in, that house is going
that's
away.
When they moved. They foreclosed and they were just like, let's get the fuck out of here.
And it's the only time he ever put this sword down, correct? That's the only time in the whole movie
he's
ever
use his real penis instead of his sword penis.
Indeed, because the sword is either in his hand or it's in the ground.
Right.
He never puts it down anywhere, but this, he put it like, I don't know.
I think Jason Momoa spent a lot of time thinking about what iconic sword moves he could do.
Mm-hmm. My God.
That would be different, but equally iconic from
it makes
Arnold.
Me think of Captain Hammer.
In the ground.
But the text that I got from Eric was just a re-texting of your quote. This isn't a talkwam, it's a fuckwam.
There is a quote from the article to go along with that.
Okay. Tell us what Josh has to say about the fuckwam.
And then Tamara and Conan have sex. Think The Room sex. And you'd think, being the smart people that they are, they'd screw in the bushes a short ways from the ship for an hour or so she can get back easily. Nope. They have sex and sleep a whole night in some random cottage miles away from the boat so she can waltz out later and get kidnapped. But hey, you get to see Conan's ass.
And she waltzes into a completely different, like,
area.
An entire different ecological biome.
Don't they go back to sand dunes?
Like, you cross over from a fuck house at the bottom of a tidal cave. Into
this forest.
Sherwood
Forest. Yeah.
And when
she was singing too.
She's humming as I was traipsing. I couldn't help but think in my head,
the McGillic Gorilla underscore.
She was traipsing.
Yeah.
Indeed.
She was traipsing for a rapesing.
What? If that wasn't funny, I might be offended, but I'm not.
Traipsing for a rapesing.
Because
she's immediately accosted by the bad guys.
Right. And Conan wakes up and he's like, oh, where's my winch? And she's gone, obviously kidnapped.
Stupid refractory period.
So then he goes to this kingdom, or the city of thieves.
Maybe, you know what, from this point on, it's just a garbled mess of crap.
The movie blows its O-ring.
He goes to the city of thieves to find the dude that said he owed his life so that he can get into his castle, because he's got the keys.
He has a
everything.
Key to the secret door.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so they go through this underwater dungeon, and then there's a kraken.
Kraken! I forgot about the kraken.
And they're keeping people in cages and whatever,
yeah.
And they get away
from
them.
I just want to say that, like, what's his name? Saeed?
Yeah,
that
his friend with
I
the patch.
I thought that guy was a good actor.
He's a good actor and just completely misused in this film.
Yeah.
So misused. The worst thing about him is, like, he sees him briefly earlier in the movie. He's like, hey, I'm a thief. If you ever need a thief, come find me.
Yeah.
Call me! Call me! And they show, like, the shot from the top of the castle wall. Seriously! Me and Shannon are like, call you later, thief! Call you later! I'll Facebook you!
It's going to become relevant to me later.
That was one of my most favorite parts. When they would, like, because they did it a bunch of times where they would pan back and you'd see the CGI scene, you know, with all the little people wandering over here and like the whole big picture. And that was one of the best ones.
The slightly CGI, but, like matte painting.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they didn't let you just be like, the art in that, like, I should sit at the table. The art in that was good. Like,
yeah.
The concept art for those moments was like clearly by a skilled artist. And they like, it conveyed what that place was.
Yeah.
I didn't need a damn subscript telling me where we were.
How many? But you know,
that's
the
right,
art on
it
the
came
website
up every time.
Like
City of Argolon, City of Thieves.
Yeah.
Yeah. Every time they change locations, there's the establishing concept art, like
you don't
painting.
You don't establish the City of Thieves and spend all of 30 seconds there.
Yeah.
You know, so the City of Thieves. Let's see. I met that one thief here. And then you go in, and he fights the guy. He's like, "No, no, no! Wait, I know this guy."
He
don't cool.
even fight.
And
he
basically drags him up. He's like, "I want you to go open the castle door to this scary place." He's like, "Oh no, it's too scary." Okay, I'll do it. Oh, I want to go home. Come on. Okay, open the thing for you. Can I just? Oh no, you have to go with me all the way down to the Kraken hole, and then you have to run around while the Kraken slaps its big tentacles at you for.
Yeah.
A big, worthless...
Seemingly 400 hours.
So worthless. I mean, they're breaking into a fortress, right? Where there's
yeah.
guards, and there's, like, it's fortified with an army of bad guys, right? But then they wander off to this other crumbling thing where
they go to the Skull Cave.
They go to the Skull Cave where it's just Conan and the bad guy.
It's a summer.
Oh, the Skull Cave. Do you remember the scene?
No. But in the fortress that he's breaking into... They have her tied down to the slab with the sacrificial dagger right at her throat.
Indiana Jones.
And like, we are going to you any second.
Cut him off!
There.
And it's like, yeah. And then, wait, you know what? We should really do this at the Skull Cave. with the sun coming up over the thing.
Guys,
I'm
just not feeling the ambiance here. The feng shui is off. Let's just get the elephants. Let's move this. Let's move this marble wheel.
And then they did move it. And then there's that one shot of like Rose McGowan over Daddy's shoulder trying to hand him something. And you can tell... it's not even acting. It's the actress being like, take the goddamn thing that I'm handing you, you actor who doesn't respond to me correctly.
Do you know what would have been even more
amazing.
Awesome? Is if they had drugged the boat to the Skull Cave.
Yes, it would
have
been
just
really
like,
cool.
Like, that's like driving down to the corner.
And you know, I do
cigarette.
Have to
put
say,
the marble
like, the
wheel
shot,
on the boat.
The
well,
shot of
the
skull,
skull cave
was pretty cool.
We don't have time to wait for the boat.
The boat's still in the shop. That guy on the rock that fell through the roof really fucked up the axle.
But weren't they were threatening to kill her and do horrible things to her, and all they did was just
like prick her hand.
Drop
yeah.
I don't know. If I was that girl, I'd be like, oh, okay, cool. So
is
I can go home now? That's all
you
need? Because it awoke
should've
it.
Should've just said something.
Yeah.
I mean, and then the thing came to life and there was the
And I kept waiting. I kept waiting for the evil daughter to make her move and usurp the power or steal the hat.
Nope.
Or kill the girl.
She just gets her hand
or cast
off.
A spell.
No, she just has a really hard time walking down the steps in those boots.
And then when he puts
She was on her way, but she couldn't get there.
He puts the horrible tentacle hat on when it comes to life from the blood. It's
the
like,
chocolate
oh,
starfish.
Shit! Now
Predator?
he's gonna have some power. He didn't even turn into the scary Andre the Giant monster
from the
movie.
Destroyer.
There
yeah.
isn't even a remotely. There's no change.
It's
just
like I can start killing everybody now, but I guess I'll just fall into this lava.
You just have a sinister hat.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Sketch Screenings makes a good point on this issue too. It says. Oh, hey, you know that main bad guy who's trying to become a god? He totes does it. He puts the tentacle hat on and supposedly becomes all-powerful. I say supposedly because he never once uses his godlike powers, except for the one time the script demands it. And then he gets defeated by falling into lava. Oh, lava, you make fools of us all. Even gods, for no goddamn reason.
And the
that's what was horrible.
And
right?
His tentacle hat just gives him a +1 to bluff.
Because he's already wanting to bring back his wife. So then when he sees his daughter dead, then he's like, oh, I know what I'm gonna do now. I'm gonna bring back my wife.
Who was apparently a sorceress, right? I mean, she was a sorceress who's.
Mm-hmm.
Who, if she's brought back, will be super powerful. But then...
She had the power to scowl.
So, Conan... So, a bunch of shit happened.
But they were threatening her in a very Temple of Doom way. You're right, Molly.
Well, how it ends?
It was. I think Shannon and I were sitting there going, "Golly ball!" Yeah. And like expecting her heart to be ripped out and Data to come in and be like,
"Get out! Call him Dr. Jones."
So, and apparently, like, the really unfortunate thing is that the Skull Cave is not up to code.
Because it falls apart. All because Conan put his sword through the bridge.
But it was really just, cool watching it crumble, that shot while they're walking around.
Such a it's like, okay, it's time to end the movie, so just crush the cave, throw the guy in the lava, and then it's like jump cut.
I like
to Conan and the girl on the beach or something, right?
Well, he takes her back, he takes her to the city she was trying to get to escape Zim. Her old
isn't there like a jump cut to where they're
there is, and you can see the Skull Cave like crumbling in the background as they're
the
walking away.
Falls
like,
I like to refer to that as a load-bearing villain.
You kill him, his whole thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
it's like a very common in video games.
Well,
like,
so then
they need to go somewhere. I guess that starfish mask was holding up this whole place.
How did it end? His sword. Right?
Yeah, well, he goes, he takes her to the village, and then they have like a, he's like, yeah, I'm totally going to call you.
Right.
Takes, back to the monastery.
Yeah. And then he goes to the village and says that he avenged his dad. Yeah, his village.
His burnt out.
And has the sword, because he got it from the daughter.
He got a sword.
And raised
it
up.
He killed the guy.
And then we see the Conan logo.
I think we need another CGI baby at the end.
Anyway, that's
I like that they tried to link the ending to the opening with him raising the sword like his dad raised him.
Mm. Is that what it was?
No.
I don't know.
Nope.
I thought it was more paying homage to the posturing Arnold does in the first one with his sword.
I thought it was probably He-Man and She-Ra, and that's what you do when you don't know what to do.
Yeah. Well, we're out of things to stab. How about the sky?
Oh my god. So, we want to bring up the point, why is it so hard to film fantasy? Like, why is it hard to please audiences? Why do people feel the need to make all of the mistakes that the filmmakers from the new Conan made and so many others make? And we're going to explore that topic in our next podcast a lot. That is the topic of the next podcast. We want to talk about a little bit of it right now.
Well, I guess it's just in relation to this particular movie. Like, what went wrong? Why is it so difficult to pull off something that looks so cool in a Frank Frazetta painting on the cover of Conan the Avenger to, you know, a fully fleshed story? I mean, maybe it's too simplistic.
The formula seems off right now.
I just think that maybe they might need somebody who loves it to make it.
Well, I think they get wrapped up in the costumes and the stunt work and the, okay, we're going to have a fight scene here, so.
But not too much on the story.
But they lose track of the story completely, but the whole reason people like this stuff is because of the stories. Mm-hmm. They read these great books where these stories were rich. And
when Peter Jackson made Lord of the Rings, what made it so good was that he knew, he was such a fan of the story and he loved it so much that he knew what were the elements that made him love the story, and he was able to put that onto to film somehow.
And one of the rare instances where the creator, producer, director was also the writer who had that passion.
Yeah.
And maybe it just kind of takes that sort of auteur approach.
I don't think the people who made this movie and who, you know, particularly like produced and executive produced this movie, I don't think they, you know, they're not the people who read these books. They're the people who looked at the cover art and said, "Yeah, that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, more muscles. Yeah,
money.
Yeah, red."
Or maybe
they
haven't even read the books, and all they've seen is the Conan or the Barbarian and the Destroyer, and just wanted to, you know, reboot the film franchise.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people who have read the books, the gentleman that I got, he loaned me the big, huge compilation thing, and when I told him we were doing this podcast, he lit up and was like, "I've been reading this stuff since I was a kid. The whole world of Conan is important, and it's a story that should be told, and I'm glad that people are failing at it, because maybe that means someday somebody will get it right. But the fact that this world is so pre-Tolkien and it paved the way for everything, like, that's why people love it." But filming for fantasy, I mean, we talked about Krull earlier, and there's all these movies from when I was a kid, Krull, The Dark Crystal, all of these things that were so bad by today's standards, but it was because of the storytelling.
Yeah.
It wasn't because of the special effects or the formula, or we have to have this certain actor, or we have to be ridiculously demonstrative. Born of battle means on a battlefield. You know,
yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever.
So terrible.
We're going to give you the
not
plot in the first 5 minutes and then completely ignore it for the rest of the movie and not even make the characters care about it.
Yeah, and I don't even think this, like, I mean, this movie lacked even the visual richness of the Frank Frazetta. You know, this was a brown movie,
right?
That was also a piece of shit.
Yeah,
and
but
any
it was,
of those
it was
shots.
Brown. It was a brown film.
Yeah.
Thinking about it now, it occurs to me like I'm just trying to think who would get this right, like who would get the tone, like
Peter
these,
Jackson.
These not even
no.
Peter Jackson,
no.
I don't think,
no,
because these stories are not Tolkien. You know what I mean?
Right.
They're pretty bare bones, kind of raw, visceral, simple kind of escapism, but they have a darkness
Let's
and a mood to them. It's like David Lynch would probably direct the ultimate Conan movie.
That would be kind of cool.
If it's something like Lost Highway, where it's just kind of like something creepy is happening and you don't know how it's happening, it's like dream-like, nightmarish. That's kind of like what Robert E. Howard's prose provokes. Is this like scary darkness? The wizard is scary because you don't quite get a good look at him.
Well,
you don't quite know what he's doing, but you know that like the guy's gonna die, or I don't know.
I think
you
the
know,
guy
is a weird monster that's been summoned from somewhere, and sure you're gonna go in there with your sword and hack its limbs off, but it's not gonna look like an episode of Spartacus made for
right.
You know, AMC.
Well, I think the guy who's working in this visual mode we've already mentioned once in talking about the Immortals is Tarsem Singh, and he's not somebody who, I mean, you know, if we're not dealing with a Tolkien level like plot and worlds to build, but you're dealing with visuals and you need to present a world that is visually arresting. I think I'll probably talk about this more on the next episode, but I think the problem with fantasy, filming fantasy, is when an audience looks at fantasy, it's in the past, and an audience says, oh, that's not how that was.
Right.
When the audience looks to the future, they only have to suspend disbelief enough to say, oh, that could be like that. The world could be that way.
It's believable.
So whether you look at like a Blade Runner, where the world really could be that way. At the time, that seemed like a very, like, oh, this is super dirty and it's really overcrowded. Or you look at, like, a Fifth Element where things are very extreme and super colorful and kind of the... I mean, it's a very similar world, actually, where it's a very hyper-populated place with a lot of diverse people and a hectic environment around the main character.
And the system is still screwed up.
Yeah.
Those could almost be the same
believable.
World.
They could be the same world. It's just Blade Runners at the bottom of those tall buildings that Bruce Willis is flying through in the Fifth Element.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's a lot more range in the world of sci-fi where you suspend disbelief in saying the world could be that way, but when you're going into fantasy, you're comparing it to the past. This is not my understanding of what the world was like.
I almost feel like the filmmakers abuse the fact that sci-fi or fantasy fans are willing to suspend their disbelief further than your average viewer. You know, they're willing to suspend their disbelief to believe, you know, something that's absolutely magical or crazy or
well, I think
far
that's
out.
Their thought. I don't know if that's true.
But I think they abuse that.
Yes,
so they use
it
as sort of just like, oh, well, they'll believe anything. We don't have to make it real or believe it.
Well, but this, they even took the epic fantasy genre and made it into an action movie. They, like, disregarded the fact that it was fantasy in the first place. He bitch slaps a horse with some chains. You go to an action movie and
you
like,
guys, there are two distinct horse punches in this film.
But you go to an action movie with a bunch of your friends and you know exactly what you're getting and you have the loud raucous oh my god did you see that he kicked it at moments and for this we did that so many times as a group. It's not about the fantasy, like people,
that's the reaction they were going for, really.
I know, but it's
movie,
like
right?
It's almost like they underestimated the people who would come see this opening weekend
because
they were going for what's
up
against Captain America. They weren't going for this epic fantasy adventure.
They never had the authentic vision to begin with, like you said.
Yeah, I think the big comparison I kept making when I was thinking about, because I only watched Conan the Barbarian. I haven't seen Destroyer, but I watched Barbarian and I watched New Conan, which I think are the most closely related films of the series, you know, like New Conan is trying to be Barbarian in some way. And
there were more nods to the first movie than to the source material.
Yeah, certainly. So, but like what I kept coming back to is like old Conan and Conan the Barbarian. I felt like I was being sort of introduced to the world, like by a. This is gonna. Oh God, my nerd card is gonna get so punched for
this.
Do it. But like I was being introduced to the world and the characters and the scenario by like a good dungeon master. You know, like, mm-hmm. like I felt like a nerd was in control of that film, and like there was a lot of,
or something.
Yeah, there's a lot of visual richness to it. There was a lot of like Frazetta moments. So there are a lot of like visually arresting moments and stuff like that. And then this movie felt like if you let the captain of the wrestling team be the DM, and he's sort of making fun of you the whole time.
Yeah.
Like this was Conan for MMA fans, not Conan for D&D fans.
Totally.
Eric Solonis has to leave us to go to a super important rehearsal, so we would like to gather his thoughts about anything we've talked about or upcoming. We're going to spend just a little bit of time talking about Game of Thrones stuff, Death of Dragon update, and Peter Dinklage and the Emmy and all that, but what do you want to say before you go, Eric?
I suppose I could sum up one last quote here from the thing that I think is interesting.
Yes, one last
okay.
Conan review.
Because this is kind of along the lines of you know, why the movie didn't work. It says, okay, he says, there's also some crap about a magic hat with tentacles, no, seriously, being assembled that will turn the main baddie into a god. But if Conan doesn't care about it, why should I? No, seriously, their own character doesn't care about the main plot they took so much time to create. He never goes after the bad guy to stop him from becoming all evil. The first half, he's going after him to avenge his father. Then the second half, he's going after him because, I shit you not, to save the girl he fucked.
Mm-hmm.
He totally deflowered the pure blood chick the bad guy need for their ritual and just goes back to get her. But apparently the ritual still works, I guess. Who knows? Everything in this movie is just so awful. Laughingly bad, but not so bad you should spend money on it. The moral of this movie is things just happen for no goddamn reason.
Thank you, Josh. Maybe,
just a counterpoint. Maybe they did it in the butt.
That
pure blood. Pure blood. Sex is sex.
There's no blood in your butt.
Okay.
And on that note,
when I watched Conan the Barbarian,
maybe they did it in the butt.
That's evil magic.
Anyway,
I'm just asking questions.
That's awesome.
No, you totally touched upon the tone of the original. I mean, the fact that the original Conan, you felt like some of the narrator is establishing like a D&D setting. I mean, these books are where D&D came from.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like they D&D
sword
wanted,
and sorcery, like that genre.
Exactly.
From, yeah.
I mean, it came from this fiction, and then it's like, wow, those stories are so great.
This is, I mean, this is what that's why Gary Gygax, one of the creators of D&D, got so up in arms about the first Conan movie,
right?
Like we're doing now. I mean, imagine the editorial.
But he's complaining about how they missed the mark, and you're saying about how they hit it.
They got closer.
They got closer, exactly.
You know, it wasn't disrespectful to my face.
And ultimately, that's what it is to be a fantasy fan, is you end up sort of taking what you can get, right?
Mm-hmm.
Really, right?
Yeah.
When it comes to fantasy adapted for the screen.
Unless Peter Jackson is doing it.
Unless Peter Jackson's doing it, and yeah, we've got two Hobbit movies coming out.
Yeah,
in a few years.
He's set such
a high
bar.
I thought he wasn't doing the Hobbit movies.
No,
oh,
no,
he is.
They're in production.
Oh, now he is.
He's doing like unprecedented access. Like,
all right,
you can go on a website and like get behind the scenes videos and like
he's doing
that's just smart.
There are these video blogs.
Fucking smart.
That are just amazing. It's amazing what they're letting you see. There's this hilarious image of Ian McKellen wearing 3D glasses. They're filming in 3D, but he's all Gandalfed out.
That's awesome.
And he's wearing 3D glasses, and it's remarkable how open
sweet.
They're being.
I haven't seen any of that. I've seen like promotional photos of the dwarf, the 12 dwarves, in all their costumes. Actually, there's a great scene of the 12 dwarves, the actors and their 12 like little people doubles. So like when I was looking, I was like, "There's like way too many dwarves in this picture."
Right.
Like, okay. There's like one. There's a big guy and a little guy.
Yeah.
And
do we know what those are going to be rated? Riley and I read The Hobbit. I mean, it took a while, but it was like
I guarantee
book.
It won't be more than PG-13.
I want to take her. I want.
Has
I mean,
she seen the Lord of the Rings movies?
Yeah, she's seen all of them.
Well then.
yeah, you might as well.
I don't know. I just, but you never know. Like, is he making the Hobbit exactly Lord of the Rings style? Is he going
Hobbit,
further?
The Hobbit
is it
was
different?
Like Lord of the Rings light, really.
Pretty
when
much.
It, like
yeah.
on the page, anyway.
Uh-huh.
But
I
don't think Peter. I don't think Peter Jackson's taking that approach.
No,
it's
okay.
way family
he's
friendly.
Filming,
it really
he's
is.
Filming these movies as you know, like.
So it's not going to be like the Rankin Bass.
No.
Greatest adventure lies just ahead.
Oh my god.
The chances, the changes.
Oh, do you want to switch tracks? Bilbo Baggins, bravest little hobbit of them all.
Needle is off the record.
Thanks, Nimoy.
Bilbo! Do you have any Game of Thrones stuff?
Well, I'm in the middle of the Feast for Crows, and it's awesome. Can't wait to get to A Dance for Dragons.
Where are you? Which part did you
I can't wait till we're all on the same page,
yeah.
by the way. Not
Brienne of Tarth just got to the Whispers, and Shagwell killed Nimble Dick. That's
okay.
the last thing I read.
Quality stuff.
Quality stuff. Where are you?
I am just about a fifth of the way into A Dance with Dragons.
I'm still done with it.
Me too.
You're
I finished
still finished.
It. There were... three chapters toward the end that, and it doesn't mean anybody died, but there were three chapters toward the end that after each one, I had to stop for the day because
yeah.
I was crying so much.
Let me ask you this.
So
in,
much.
In fear of, you'll probably spoil me, but, you know, reading it
skip
now.
Skip ahead 30 seconds. that's
you
how
know,
they do it.
I know.
Well, I almost wish.
<I do it. laughs>
Skip ahead 30 seconds.
No, don't skip ahead. We haven't even. I don't even know what he's gonna
he's
ask me.
Spoil.
No, I mean just like you know, like let's say George R. R. Martin. There's the portion of the book that is the parallel companion to
mm-hmm.
A Feast for Crows, and then there's a portion at the end that finally moves the whole plot forward for everybody.
And it's not even at the
Does
end.
Does it feel
like
a shift, or I mean, is it a organic, just sort of reintroduction of. All right, let's finally go back to Westeros and see what's happening down, you know, down there.
It's pretty obvious.
Like,
yeah.
It's pretty
okay.
obvious when it's like, oh, I don't know this information.
I think it's
or,
a Jaime chapter that we come back to first or a Cersei, one of the two.
I didn't
okay.
really realize which chapter it was. You know, the beginning, you know some of the stuff he's reintroducing, but you're getting it from different perspectives. Yay for that. And then when you start moving on, it's, wait, this was happening... And I know that it's happening while this is happening.
Well, there's good character cliffhangers established for every character at the end of every one of his books. So
yeah.
at the end of A Feast for Crows, it's kind of like, ooh, something big's going to happen with the Greyjoys. Ooh, something big's going to happen with Sam.
I
something
love
big's going to happen
stuff.
With Brienne. Something, Jaime's got to rush back to King's Landing to...
Or does
to,
he?
Or does he? Okay. So do any of those things get resolved in this book, or is there still... kind of the same.
There's not a lot of resolving in this book. There's not a lot of resolving at all. And for me, this probably won't spoil anything. But I think there were like two, maybe three Arya chapters, and that was it. And Arya's my favorite. She's my favorite. And
there's a
her,
lot of her in Feast for Crows.
There
though,
is
so.
A lot of her, and I wanted the same amount in this book. I really
no.
did, but I didn't get it. But
you don't get that.
Let me ask you this too, then. Okay, so you know, George has said once upon a time, like years ago. His original vision was at some point, like after the first book or two or three, to take a 5-year break and have all the children characters be reintroduced as adults, like further along there. All the Stark children, at least. You know, just kind of like, okay, we don't like. He wanted to skip over the whole thing where Arya goes and becomes what she becomes.
He
and
can't. It's too awesome.
Later.
Yeah, I think that would have been so unsatisfying.
That ship is completely sailed, right?
Yeah, no, he can't do that.
No,
okay.
he can't. I mean, and if he does from right now where it's at, I could see that happening.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Does he get to a point where he could conceivably
yeah, Arya,
skip ahead a little bit?
Arya,
yeah.
only Arya, I think, of the Stark kids could go quiet for a while.
Yeah, I don't want
conceivably,
that. I don't want that
I think
at all
he knows,
it's so
I think he knows how much people are in love with where she's at
mm-hmm.
in the plot and her just her general arc that they don't want to leave her.
And
okay.
Bran could go silent because we get the other we get to sort of see what he's doing from
yeah.
other perspectives, but we're the I can't
and you can
skip
see,
ahead 10 seconds,
I
but we're the only ones that know that it's what he's doing.
Does he kinda go silent for a part of this book?
Yeah. I mean there's
it,
not
it
a lot
it feels like he's about to where I'm
yeah.
at.
There's not a lot of Bran. In the back half.
But there's some serious Bran right up front.
And
yeah.
there has to be for him to be silent, I'm putting quotes around that, in the back half. Because he's not silent. Like,
Yeah.
He's so not silent.
Yeah, he's around.
There's been...
not in the traditional way. He's not totally. POV.
Exactly.
Okay. Oh, no, that's fucking cool. That's cool.
It's so cool. And, you know, I was really disappointed with a lot of this book. Like, it just went really slow, and it's all mindset, and, like, yay for Barristan, but I don't give a shit. But we needed his POV.
Martin talked about it, and he couldn't get out. Like, he couldn't get out of Marine.
Yeah.
That's the big problem with this book, with Feast for Crows. Everything outside of Marine is intensely captivating to me. Everything.
I agree.
Like, everything. And that pains me, because I think Daenerys is a great character, but it seems like once characters step into Marine, it's just like, it feels like Star Wars Episode One. Like, let's talk about trade tariffs.
There you go.
Yeah, it does.
Exactly. I mean, the idea of it, it's like, wow, she captured the city. Wow, she's got the gumption, she's going to stick around.
Wow, she's passing legislation.
Like, wow, she's in love with Dario. Who cares?
Yeah, the Marine situation is with a few, obviously, notable exceptions. It is a intractable mess. And every time you go back there, you sort of hate it. Because
But there's a resolution to that within this book, right? Okay.
The most satisfying for me so far has been what's satisfying in the other books. When you have one character who is actually in the vicinity of another character and they have no idea.
Yeah.
And you as the reader have all that awesome information. I've always loved that about the books. And there's not a lot, like not tons and tons of it in this book, but the times that it's happened, it's pivotal.
Mm-hmm. And you still like the characters.
Yeah.
You don't always understand them, but you still like, I mean, you still want Daenerys to get to where she's going. You still want Ser Barristan to kind of rebuild his honor. Like, there are still good characters in Marine. They're just
You even still root
swallowed.
For Jorah, even though he's kind of a douche.
Yeah, sure.
Put a dollar
but,
on
I mean, there's still
jar.
Good characters in that Jordan. City, but he just gets swallowed up in the political intrigue that is just not interesting.
Season 2 is being filmed, and like we said earlier, they're talking about how season 2 they're going way farther with all the fantasy aspects, that there's more dragons, there's actually direwolves.
They had hinted that they were gonna go big with the wolf.
And
so
even
the wolves
location.
Are gonna be present and real and CGI and big and awesome. That's what we're hearing.
That's what we're hearing. And I read a little thing about how they're filming in 3 different countries right now, and part of what they're filming north of the wall, they only have like 5 hours of daylight at a time because they're near the Arctic Circle filming this stuff. So it's very, they're going big.
That reminds me of there's this episode of 30 Rock where Jenna Maroney, the character Jenna Maroney, played by Jenna Malone, she leaves the show for a while to go film a movie about werewolves in Iceland.
Oh my God.
But she does it during the summer, so there's only like 14 minutes of darkness.
Oh my God.
For their movie about werewolves.
Wow.
But up there, I mean, the things that are about to happen up at the wall and north of the wall, they don't need a lot of daylight, so it's okay.
I'm a little underwhelmed by these early Jon chapters that are so much about the minutia of being the Lord Commander and going through and counting the casks of maid and stuff in the storehouse.
That feels like it serves a purpose, you know, because it...
Well, that's true. But, you know, it's interesting... You know, they're spending so much time at Castle Black. Early on in the book, this crossed my mind when I was reading it recently. It's just like, I didn't think we would have this much time. Like, when they did the ranging north of the wall and they went up to the Fist of the Iron Men, I thought we wouldn't see Castle Black again. But then all of a sudden, they're just there. They're just dug in there again. And there's
it's necessary.
So
the
much
information
of it
is necessary. And I like that we get Sam and John's different perspectives, and learning what the other one knows and doesn't share with the other one is pretty cool. But all that information about inventory is pretty important.
And you get you're going to get to see some very cool John non-traditional management skills.
Yeah,
shall we say, with Jon Snow on the wall.
He's an innovative Lord
he
Commander.
He is outside the box thinker.
He is. I really like Jon Snow. I want to bring up one thing that I want people to watch before you guys got here. Eric and Brennan and I were watching this little, and I'm sure you know more about it than I do, but it's a little, like, RPG, Nintendo-esque Game of Thrones game, and like somebody recorded themselves playing it, and it's hilarious. It's hilarious.
It's not an actual game. It's just like
a no, I think
video.
It is.
It's
like Eric said, he was playing it.
The game.
Is
oh, really?
It the Sensual Adventures of Cersei Lannister?
No, but at the very beginning, the very very beginning is a Jaime and a Cersei in a room, and you can choose like thrust, talk, or blah, and he chooses thrust, and it's just like thrusting up against Cersei, and then it's. You've been spotted by a Bran. What do you do? And then there's like three choices: attack, skills, kill, and you choose kill.
Guess.
And it's really he's only 10. Are you sure? And then you see yes and no, yes. And then he like bounces him off the wall and out of the room. And it's like,
yeah,
we understand.
That's probably a video. I don't think that's a real game.
I don't
it
think
was
it's
real.
Real.
Eric
I don't
said
think
he was playing
real,
it,
yeah.
But it was super funny and everybody should watch it. I was laughing a lot and just the little finger saying,
should
"You should trust me."
Is it a YouTube? YouTube item or where
I
can
think
we direct
so. I'm
our,
sure if you just Google RPG Game of Thrones.
RPG Game
right
of Thrones.
There.
There is a real RPG, Song of Ice and Fire, like, you know, pen and paper D&D
mm-hmm.
type setting.
Well, and there is a real-time strategy game coming out. Yeah, I think it's called the Game of Thrones, I want to say it's called Origins? It's not the Sensual Adventures of Cersei Lannister, but there is like political intrigue and stuff in it, so it doesn't, I don't know, the things are a little mixed on it, but could be good. It's weird that they're coming from it in an RTS way. And for those who aren't huge gamers...
Because, especially since George tends to gloss over the minutia of the
right.
battle. And
yeah,
the,
I mean, yeah, it's a real-time strategy, so it's like moving units into positions and flanking and charging defenses, you know. It's just kind of a... It's a way to, like, gamify the world. You know,
yeah.
There are a lot of battles happening and stuff like that, but but I think people would have, like... I think... The Game of Thrones game is actually the Dragon Age series, to me. Like, that is... That series by BioWare, that's, like, that is the game... The closest thing you get to a Game of Thrones
no,
game.
No, you're right, you're right.
These worlds... You get these worlds of people, you get... Lots of different regions, you get...
It's not...
Lots of intrigue.
The setting, but it's so inspired by it.
Yeah.
And that there is the depth of detail in that in
and
Dragon
it's,
Age.
Yeah, it's hard fantasy. I mean, the monsters are much more prevalent because, you know, you're a gamer.
You have
to have
something
them.
To kill every
yeah.
5 minutes, right?
You're not just killing
you can't
people.
Can't just, like, have Joffrey zombies? That would be sweet.
No, but good point. Yeah, and the creators of Dragon Age have noted how heavily influenced they were by
yeah.
A Song of Ice and Fire.
There was a teaser, season 2 teaser that I saw online that was just lame. It was totally lame.
It wasn't a, it was, yeah, it was a teaser of a teaser.
It was a teaser
It was
of
just
teaser.
A graphic with like one line of dialogue, right?
Woo! Yeah, it was stupid.
The Emmys aired 2 weeks ago, right?
Hey.
Yay, Peter Dinklage!
Peter Dinklage, best supporting actor
he
for
thanks his
a
dog
Game of
sitter.
Thrones.
Nathan Fillion in Castle... He deliberately threw in a Game of Thrones reference. They find this body and it's been cut in half by a sword and he's all, oh, sword! That's very Game of Thrones. And then in his Twitter feed he's like, did I deliberately do a Game of Thrones line in the hopes that they'll put me on the show one day? Yes, I did.
Nathan Fillion.
Right?
Well,
and then people went nuts with like who he would be cast as. So I just think
That's
he should
funny.
Show up as Captain Hammer.
Isn't
it
interesting
great.
There's like this whole like sort of echelon of actors who land like iconic geek roles and that then they just like feed off of it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's like there's the people that will refuse to go sign anything at the Star Trek conference. And then there's the people who just love the fact that they're on one episode of Star Trek. Real steel.
Yeah. Yeah.
Evangeline Lilly is in
yeah.
that movie.
Sure.
And it just crossed my mind. I was like, I haven't seen her in anything since Lost. It's like, oh, it makes sense that she's in something that's like genre-ish. Not that she's a genre person. Of all the cast of Lost, she didn't really get into the sci-fi elements of it at all. But it makes sense that she has a better chance getting cast in a film with sci-fi elements
yeah.
than not.
Before we end this one, I also want to thank Joshua Daniels,
the noir guy.
Joshua Daniels, sketchscreenings.blogspot.com. Joshua is a guy that I met at the Great Plains Theater Conference a few years ago. He had a really interesting play. He's a really cool guy, and I love the fact that he's all over the internet, but he has a really fun point of view that's a lot like ours, so
cool.
I thought it would be a good addition.
Well, I liked what he contributed today. That was really funny stuff.
Definitely. All right, so that's more than enough tangents to veer off on. At least we had a little good Song of Ice and Fire discussion in there at some point.
Right.
Okay, so we'll be back with another podcast. Top three fantasy
films of all time.
And
or
your top three favorite moments from the Game of Thrones
season one. And then we'll talk about, we're going to dive into more of what they're doing to fulfill the diehard fantasy needs of the audience for season two. We'll probably dive into some Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings stuff because they're sort of the epitome of today's, you know, now's generation
well
of what
fantasy is
and
yes.
things like that. So more on the next podcast.
More to come, folks. Thanks, and we'll see you with episode 14.
Let me tell you of the days of high adventure.
Darkwing's Dork Words, a Game of Thrones podcast. Conceived by Chuck Davis. Produced by Boombox Productions, recorded in Omaha, Nebraska. Featuring Chuck Davis, Brendan J.D. Riley, Molly Welsh, and Eric Salonis. With this week's special guest, Greg Jaxies of the New Timey Podcast Network. You can find us on iTunes or at darkwingsdorkwords.com.